Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to One Heat Minute. A very special One Heat Minute, in fact. And today I'm joined by a man who I thought we almost, just by a hair, missed each other before the show ended proper. So it almost would have been this man as the second last episode and then Michael Mann as the final one. He is such a great supporter of the show, was so kind to talk about what the work that we've done and called all man acolytes to us. He is an Oscar-winning best director. He's the one of the most fascinating and just true champions of all cinema. He described Heat himself as a film that is part of the medium. And it is my distinct pleasure to talk today to Guillermo del Toro. Welcome to One Heat Minute, sir.
Good morning. How are you, everybody?
Oh man, I'm just completely stoked to talk to you again in person. Thank you so much for your generosity and your support around everything that we did with One Heat Minute. Let's just start with you being a man acolyte, a man who's feels like people like George Miller and Michael Mann are, you know, so important to the medium, and they make such bold choices. Tell me about your love of Michael Mann, our shared love, in fact, of Michael Mann.
Well, you know, I think the first thing is very rare that somebody has a voice as distinctive. You know, that when people talk about auteurs, I always think that the notion of auteur really can be applied to people that control, that really have a very strong control of all parts of the medium, that can write, produce, direct, even if they don't do it all at once, or they do it in shaping the material like Hitchcock did in his time, you know? But I think you can talk about Claire Denis, you can talk about Truffaut, you can talk about Fellini, you can talk about anybody, and man is as distinctive as any of these auteurs. I mean, it takes a few seconds to know you're in a Michael Mann movie.
Yeah.
He has influenced countless of TV shows and films in the genre, outside the genre, like I think Chris Nolan's creation of Batman is, reinvention of Batman is impossible to imagine without Michael Mann interceding for a Gotham City that is much more edgy and much more gritty in the audiovisual sense. I think that nobody that loves cinema and that wants to direct will ignore many, not one, but many sequences.
Yes.
In Superman's films. I mean, everybody doing an action scene has to study the heist, you know, the bank robbery scene in Heat. Everybody studying character shaping on a movie can study Thief. Yeah. Everybody trying to approach a classic piece of material like Last of the Mohicans should approach that movie because it's how to make a material that is from another period feel alive and now, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I think aside from admiring him formally and in the narrative way, I also love him as a person. He has been a director that has always supported openly and from the beginning our careers, Alfonso, Alejandro, myself, in different ways. When we started coming to Hollywood, when we came here in the 90s, it was a very different thing. And Michael has always been, we call him Uncle Mike, because he is like very avuncular with us, very generous, always generous, always very warm. And he has, I mean, he the way he shapes material is completely unique.
Yes.
You know, I've had the pleasure of sharing many dinners and many social occasions with him. We always invariably end up talking about his movies. and I try to fish for influences, like we discussed Jean-Pierre Melville, and and I talk about Westerns, and you know, he's not shaped, he's shaped by life and his experience in police work and his experience with the real criminal element as an almost investigative, immersive report. So he is not a guy that watched a lot of movies and basically learned the world through the movies. He learned the world through the world. And in that, he is also quite unique. He's two-fisted, hard-boiled, humanistic, gritty, pitiless. You know, he's I think, and I still intend one day to interview him for a book or a documentary series, whichever comes first. I mean, we were very much pursuing that when the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
And then nothing could happen with that. I'm 56. You know, he's also of the age where, strong as he is, we didn't want to be in a room talking about anything for days. So that's, I mean, but again, you can dissect any, as you have, any minute of his films, and it's a filmmaking lesson.
Yeah, it's so great that you talk about Jean-Pierre Melville, because another huge Mann fan and Mann acolyte, Bill Gabiri, who's a friend of the show, has been on the show many times, has asked about Jean-Pierre Melville too. And I'm a recent person to Jean-Pierre Melville as to start diving into his work. And I started seeing all of this stuff in Mann, and even Michael Mann's answer about Melville publicly has been, I think that Jean-Pierre Melville and I share the same quality in that we both know real criminals. So our work, if there's any similarities in our work stylistically, it's probably because we know real criminals, and then we're like sponges for their real activities and their real processes. And that's what comes through in both of our work. But really, really special, really special, but quality.
But he definitely was in that sense. I mean, you have people that can coincide thematically, visually on some stuff, but that you see were birthed quite apart. Mm. I don't think he was a guy that said, oh, look at what Middle Bill is doing. He was doing it.
Yeah.
You know, and he was doing it as background work, and then he made it his life work, you know, and the efficiency of his storytelling, which comes from TV and the discipline of TV, you know, he has a very unique, if you gave me unlimited funds, unlimited time, and told me you're going to have to do that heist scene, I would change my name, get a new passport, and leave the country. I would not attempt it. I would not. Because, I mean, I'm very good at dissecting film. This is what I did since I was a kid. I started to see jump cuts, lens changes, dollies versus cranes, overhead, and you know, the camera is underslung or overslung on a crane. You can do different movements, and I used to, you know, just break down a scene and go, oh, this is the master, this is the coverage, I get it. He had a second camera, he had a third camera, she moved the camera like this. Whatever the director did, I'm pretty good at dissecting. And that scene, I throw my arms and say, okay, fine. I mean, because when you break down, I'm good at breaking down effects, and I'm very good at breaking down logistics. And that is an invasion during wartime, that scene.
Absolutely.
It's like planning a disembarking on an enemy territory with troops. I remember, for example, Alejandro and I were trying to break down the scene of the mauling of the bear on Revenant.
Yes.
Way, many, many months in pre-production. And Alejandro said, and then and we would say, well, the bear now attacks Leo, and now you're going to have to change the clothes, put a couple of injuries, and then the bear does this, and then you have to change the clothes again to more bloodied.
Yeah.
And then I said, and this is where you cut. And Alejandro would say, no, I'm going to keep going. I said, Alejandro, you're crazy. You cannot keep going. And he says, no, I'm going to. He says, Alejandro, you're going to have to go through hair, makeup, blood. I mean, you know, it's not about the camera and the actors. It's about all the elements that make the scene flow. And Alejandro said, no, I'm not going to cut until they roll into the ravine. And I said, you're very stubborn. You're very crazy. You're not going to do it. But I leave it at that. And of course he didn't cut. And of course he did the scene that way. And when you see the heist, and this is why it's important to compare that bank robbing scene with the first scene where they take the armored truck, you know, and it's such a staggering. The elements are staggering. You have to rig the bullets in the cars. He's using squibs. He's using cannons to break the windows. He needs to change the car for take two. And this is what, logistically, when you explain to someone how a movie is really shot and how you're dealing with wardrobe change, prop change, car change. And I always use an example. I say, you see somebody walking on pristine snow in a movie for the first time. That's a simple thing, right? Except when you think take two means somebody has to make the snow pristine again.
Yes.
For take two. And then for take three. And then for take four. And then the crane has to be in the right position. The focus puller needs to be right. The actor needs to be in the moment. This is just walking on the snow.
Yes.
Imagine, I always say, imagine the logistics of that scene. Take two of any moment. That scene is insane.
And what's more insane is you pile on the elements. And then one of my favorite moments one of my favorite moments in the entire film. One of my favorite moments is just there is a breath that Mr. Man takes when you see after the explosion of all of the windscreens happen, and there's a like a cellophane flag from the little finance that falls. It just comes down, and his instinct to just let it fall in that moment. And the thing that I think is comes to greater appreciation over time, and even talking to you now, is what take was that on?
Yeah, of course.
Was that on take 11? And you're like, or was that take 13? Who knows what take that was on? But it's like to keep going, to go something not quite here yet, and then eventually to make that all happen. And how many more cars? You got to change out, what is 11 or 12 cars in a row in any given moment as well?
Like when we were talking about his preparation for Collateral, you know, another great movie that I admire. And you know, he told me that, you know, he had Tom Cruise dressed as a delivery messenger going into offices, trying to not be recognized, trying to become this transparent gray being, you know, that is invisible to the eye. And I thought, who would have thought about doing that? Who has Tom Cruise delivering UPS or FedEx or whatever they chose, you know? But it was very smart. It's like, and we talk about the sort of quote unquote car chase element of the canoe chase on Last of the Mohicans. How to shoot a canoe chase as if it's a high speed car chase in a freeway.
Yes,
you know. And he is technically fascinating to me. If we were going to talk about the opening heist, you know, the armor truck heist, the is intrinsic to the movie. I think the whole opening takes the first 10 or 15 minutes of the movie. It takes a good chunk of the opening.
Yeah,
and it's really great how he knows you're working as an audience. He doesn't give you the planning scene.
No,
he doesn't. He never has somebody extending a map and putting a cigarette lighter and a couple of peanuts and say, they're going to be over here. We're going to come from nothing. He says, look, I'm going to keep it diagrammatic.
Yes.
Meaning he's going to show you vectors of action. Vectors of action. And it's up to you, the audience, to put it together. And what he starts doing, if you go back and watch the scene, and in fact, the entire opening, is he decides to open with very much, occasionally he goes to wider lenses, but he starts very much with long lenses.
Yes.
Isolating each individual. If they're not part of a group, you know, De Niro is crossing the hospital, coming down the steps in a very long lens or a long lens. Things are crossing in front of him, but he's isolated. He's an individual. Then, you know, Val Kilmer, long lens, wider lens, you get the sense of everything, but he is not part of a gang. You don't see him connect with De Niro. You see each of the characters, you know, Wingrove coming out of the restaurant, going into the truck, and finally isolation, and then two, he comes together with Tom Sizemore. That's one plus one, that's two. Yeah, yeah. And then the group comes together only at the moment of the heist. You know, there's that glorious low shot on a dolly, you know, of facing the sky, you know, and the dolly, which you can see when you disassemble the scene.
Yes.
You can see that the dolly went from left to right to left, back and forth during the whole, he mastered the scene in that shot. And finally you see the group together and they work with absolute synchronicity. You know, the they say 3 minutes. I think the scene from then on takes about 2.5 minutes.
Yes.
No, he's not exactly 3 minutes, but he says 3 minutes to the police being here. And it's roughly 3 minutes for the police to arrive at the scene. It's 2:30, something like that, 2:35. And I, number one, I'm glad he's close to that, but I'm also glad he's not slavish to it. He doesn't say, he doesn't make it an exercise.
There's not a countdown timer. It's not 24. In that moment, I think what's beautiful is like, he's like, Neil yells over his shoulder, De Niro is like 80 seconds left. Yes. And in that moment, you still get that, you know, and this is where I feel like it's the perfect, we talked about synchronicity. I think it's the perfect synchronicity of taste, because the more I watch that scene, the more it feels almost like a fable. You've got this giant green truck that's like a dragon that comes out and smashes something. And you've got these wraiths with their masks, these empty faces. And there's nothing more haunting and terrifying than Waingro in that moment, as they sort of, again, another inhalation in the movie where man takes a breath and stares into this chasm that his eyes, there's just black holes.
Literally black holes. And it's not accidental.
No.
No, you can see, I mean, you can see everybody's eyes except Waingro.
Except Waingro.
But also the complete dazed innocence of the armored truck guard. You know, he's like, you can see he's a blank.
Yes.
And, you know, it's, I've always been fascinated by robbery. I love the mechanics of it. I jokingly have said that if I hadn't been a director, I would have been James Cannon Thief with a lot more fat content, you know. But it's because planning it is you know, it's actually fascinating, you know, when you go into the minute of the drills and the gauge of the steel and the, you know, the material tension of the safe, blah blah blah. But what is great about this is, they know what they're gonna get. They plan the explosive perfectly, but the human factor, you know, both on the on both sides, the fact that the guys are deaf momentarily from the explosion, the fact that Waingro is like a wild card, to that degree, all those are the things that without that. It's very simple. It's what some screenplay writers call the inciting incident. Right? Yes. Without that, there would be no movie. If Waingro had held the trigger, it would have been not a homicide. They would have gotten Al Pacino.
Yeah.
Insurance would have paid. The police would have investigated reasonably, but not that intensely. Yeah. And the beauty of it is, when later they lose Waingro, another fascinating scene, you know, when they lose him in the parking lot, you know, that's the sword of Damocles hanging over their head for the rest of the movie. For the rest of the movie. And I even fantasize, I always fantasize about an alternate ending, both with George Miller and Michael Mann. I had lunch with George and I was saying, as much as I love Fury Road, I said, wouldn't it be great if Tom Hardy goes through the movie, you think he's Max, nobody calls him by his name, you know, because nobody knows it. And then you just come to the end and Furiosa, you know, you don't know her name, but he's saying, come on, hold on, stay with me. And he says, what is your name? And she says, my name's Max.
Yeah.
And then you realize you've been watching her story. Like, she is the new Max. And he just took a sip of coffee and said, interesting. Like, I don't care about your fan theories, Del Toro, you know. And with Michael Mann, I always think they're in the runway at the airport. Pacino has him on his side, and he gets a call from his unit saying, there is a dead woman in the room. This guy is the killer. And Pacino holds his side down and lets De Niro go. That's my fan fiction.
we've had the fan fiction on this show so many times because so many guests were so drawn to the tunnel scene. And that's another scene in this film that is so incredible. Matt Zoller-Zeitz was on the show and he was like, Blake, it's literally myopia. It's literally tunnel vision. It's like some of those great things that phenomenal directors get away with, where they're like, the thematics of the movie are operating on such a level that with the real hyper reality of the movie, that it just works again in perfect alignment. And I remember watching that scene and It's that you love a movie so much, you've watched it so many times, and I watch De Niro's eyes and I just wish for Neil in that moment, please, please don't get off this freeway. Please stay on this road and get out of here. And I think that's a magical quality to Michael Mann's movies, to make us so deeply emotionally invested in guys who we know aren't necessarily good people. They're bad guys.
That is because I think, you know, as much as he may do it consciously or not, or he's at the end of the day, he's shooting Westerns.
Yes.
No, and or the ethics and the cosmology of Westerns permeates the movies, because these are people that exist within the laws in the same way that marshals and outlaws exist within the laws in a Western. But at the end of the day, is the inevitability of their choices, quote unquote, by the drive. It's very primal,
yes.
Very primal, very, very much an individual manifest destiny,
yes,
of whether you want it or not. You know, your stars align this way. You know, because in theory, look, it is said you have to be able to leave everything behind in the drop of a hat, right?
Yes.
Except rage. Except. I can leave behind a house, a love, money, but
revenge.
That motherfucker, I'm not gonna leave him alive, you know. And that is beyond principle, and is beyond living by the code. Is there's a stronger code about in that says this you will not do, you know. And it comes from ethics that are not, quite frankly, they are not normal or easy to absorb, except in a mythic way.
Yes.
Or if you've lived a life of crime, I suppose. I mean, I was talking to Willem Dafoe about Animal Factory, which I love. I love that movie in the way, you know.
Overdue for a rewatch of that. Oh my God, what a movie!
I watch it often, we were talking about Eddie Bunker and Danny Trejo, who did time, both of them, right? Yeah. And Willem said their ethics inside the walls are very different from the ethics they would have dealing in the real world.
Yes,
and some people are unable to adjust again, which is very well known. It's called institutionalization and all that. But he was saying the ethics are so strong inside, and you can see in this movie, they can shoot a security guard just because why leave him alive, which is a very mechanical thing, horrible, despicable thing to do. And at the same time, he's not gonna let Wingro go free because he betrayed him. So it's impossible to reconcile.
Yeah.
And but very much a Western.
Yeah. I think, like you said, you know, your contemporary, Mr. Quentin.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Tarantino always loves to say that Westerns are so much more about the time that they're produced than the time, ultimately, than the time that they're portraying in the period. And I think that's, you know, you talk about that dynamic with Last of the Mohicans, which is that is a true contemporary view, like looking at how important the frontier wars were in the context of what ultimately becomes the United States and the plight of Native Americans and even like foretelling and foreshadowing what would be the upcoming revolutionary wars and things like that before, and then eventually the Civil War. And I think with Mann, these landscapes of LA, this West, you know, this extreme, this hyper reality, he's found a way to play these morality tales, but in contemporary stages. And I think some filmmakers want to go back to the comfort of like a Western because you can be a bit broader with your themes, but man is like, no, I want to keep the more tangible and real I can make it, the better. And I think that like, that's reflective in Manhunter and Collateral and just Heat and, you know, basically every one of his films.
But I think there is a part of, there's a very, very American essence to the United States, that is that tension between being a nation of laws and a showdown.
Yes.
with an affront.
Yes.
You know, whatever you may want to call it. And this comes from the way the country was founded. It was founded by that clash, that almost paradox.
Yes.
Because it is a paradox. You know, I think a paradox is defined as two forces in opposite directions of equal strength, right?
Yes.
And the spirit, the American spirit is that dichotomy, that paradox of a land of laws and a land of outlaws.
Yes.
And you can argue that both are equally essential and equally passionate in the soul of the country. You know, it's we can talk about genocide, slavery, the law of the gun, and at the same time, the hallowed dimension of the founding fathers and the Constitution,
yes,
and the letter of the law, blah, blah, blah. And I think that's monumental, and it casts a long, long shadow. What is interesting for me about Mann is, I love Los Angeles. I love it with a passion.
Mm.
I love it as a city. And when people say, well, LA, I don't like LA because of this or that, I say, which LA?
Yeah.
Because there are at least 100 LAs.
Yes.
You go to Koreatown or Beverly Hills. Do you go to Bel Air or do you go to East LA?
Yeah.
Do you go to Little Tokyo or you go to Little Ethiopia? And do you cross Olympic or you don't? You know,
yes.
These are completely frontier size decisions in LA. It's many different cities. And Michael Mann is one of those rare LA poets, you know, that can show you a house in Malibu made of steel and glass, or it can show you a taco stand in Koreatown.
Yes.
You know, or it can show you the magnificence of an underpass.
Yes.
You know, Pacino says, this is a good place. You know, there's escape routes here, escape routes there, freeway here, freeway there. Yeah, it's a scene in a Western, somebody saying they took the pass.
Yeah.
You know, they went through the canyon. These canyons of concrete, these canyons of steel, which again in Collateral, the idea that there is no city, I don't think there is any city in which a car stands for the id and the self.
Yes.
But LA. In LA, you are your car and your car is you.
Yes.
And an invasion of that car by a bad thought dressed in gray in a shark skin suit, you know, it's perfect. It's where the city comes alive, and the same way that noir writing you know, you can clearly, for me, my favorite noir writing is California noir.
Yes.
No, because to see beyond the sunshine, to see beyond the cliche of the Japanese gardener and the mansion and the, you know, to find all the gritty festering soul of that is fantastic. And man does it. He takes you everywhere.
Yes.
Look at this movie. This movie takes you everywhere. You're going to go to a place where they dismantled cars, a nightclub, a pit bull fighting arena, and whatever it is. And you know he knows this place very well.
Yes.
This is not a tourist.
No.
This is not a narrative tourist. This is a guy that is hardcore LA. And that happens when you go out with him, by the way. If you go out with him, I will not denounce his watering holes. But you go to his watering holes or his restaurants or his, and he says this place was founded in 1920 by so and so. He knows everything.
Yeah, I remember in our chat we were talking about Kate Manolini's, and is one of the only people, which is the place, the setting for the most famous scene in the movie of obviously De Niro and Pacino facing off. And he's one of the only people I've ever experienced. He was like, I know exactly why that place shut down. It shut down because they were greedy about rent. And this is and he just knew every single detail about how the rent. Yeah. He's like, it was extremely successful. And I don't know why the rent went up and they just got greedy and it took down an institution. And he was just so passionate. He knew it. He knew every part about it.
It was an institution.
Yeah. It was
it was a place you went to before the Academy screenings.
Yes.
You know, it was you would meet everybody. I mean, I think those places are gone. There used to be, I mean, I've been coming to LA all my life since I was a very young kid. We would come on and off every summer, and I would explore the city because I wanted to find the material for makeup effects or comic book shops or whatever. And I ended up spending a lot of time in the cars and there was a time where you had restaurants where you said you can see everybody there, yeah. Right? And at certain times, it could be Spago for the Bosch set or the first Wolfgang Puck restaurant on Sunset or Le Dome or, and Kate Mantellini was one of those that you would run into unexpected luminaries. In there, and it was a great institution.
So talking about this film and these scenes, is there any other scenes for you that really pop in this film? I know the heist scenes from a pure technical standpoint, it's so rich hearing you talk about all those different elements, but I want to jump to that moment that Wangro disappears because I wanted to just tag onto what you said, which is, that is another scene that has a supernatural quality, that the more I revisit it, when he visits and he becomes this manifestation of the Sword of Damocles, as you put it, it's just such a powerful scene for all of its stark reality and crisp, you know, plastic in the back of this boot that he's going to be put away. That moment when he disappears, the fear that's in De Niro's eyes and the way that man frames these, you know, strange the trees. It's
incredible. Mean, look, This movie is for me is, and this is like a home.
Yeah,
I live in it. And how often do I visit it? I watch it at least three times a year, at least. Mm. And every time it's on, or accidentally we pass it and we start. I watch it until the end.
Yes.
I remember we were having a dinner, a very important dinner in the Lyon Film Festival. And Michael was introducing the restored version of the film. And I went to him and said, what is restored? He says, nothing. He says, I color corrected it and remixed it a little. And I said, oh, okay, we'll watch. He says, but it's perceptible. He said, you're going to notice the colors are this or the sound is that. And I said, okay, I'll watch the first 5 minutes and then I'll reach you at dinner. And we were going to have a big dinner, everybody in the festival. I stayed for an hour and a half. I said, okay, I got to leave. At some point I got to leave, you know, but this movie, that scene, let me say to you that one of the special things about Los Angeles, in my opinion, is the night and nightlife. It's not a lonely nightlife like in Nighthawks. The LA nightlife is completely permeated by dirty neon, is completely permeated by this impossible architectural oddities. Yeah. You know, you can have a Spanish stucco or a hacienda style house, and next to it there's a futuristic or brutalist architecture, or a ship's cafeteria. And that's why I love LA. It's like a sampler of madness. And Kim Morgan says it beautifully. Nobody goes crazy quite like the Americans. There's a special way in which America goes crazy that fascinates the world. And LA is that. LA has that madness. And that scene where, you know, one of the best shots is that shot from outside where you see Tom Sizemore go to the bar momentarily before Vincent comes in.
Yeah.
And, you know, oh my God, they're casing the guy. You know, they want to make sure he doesn't escape. You never go to a mob dinner and somebody says, you sit on the front. You go, no, I don't want to sit on the front. Please. You know, you're done. And the same way and he comes in and he slams his face against the formica table. And that beautiful, wonderful, mythic shot of Tom Sizemore just looking at the other patron and going like, yeah. Sideways look. And you know, the other patron's going to fold. So you know that crime is not happening in a dark alley. It's happening in a populated cafeteria. And these guys don't care. They don't care. And then they walk through the parking lot, and there's the wonderful camera movement when Danny Trejo opens the trunk and reveals the plastic lining. And then, of course, the first time you see it, De Niro looks up at the car, and of course we stop looking down. And when we discover through him that Wayne Grove's gone, is an amazing act of prestidigitation.
Yeah.
Because Michael Mann quite literally made us look over here and put us in the mind frame of the guy. And then we look back and we go, and this is the way you forget the keys or the wallet. But yeah, in this case, they forgot the guy. And it's fantastic. And if you watch it again, the way it ends, which is really extraordinary, because he's gonna go. If I remember correctly, he goes to the beach house after this, and I think it's the shot of De Niro putting the gun down on the table. I think
yes, it is.
But in the middle, there's a shot of De Niro looking after he went under the cars and never, and then a shot that is maybe his point of view. Maybe it isn't. It's just a street shot at night. And rhythmically, this is where movies are like music. You don't have to believe it's a POV. You don't know because, and Michael Mann knows it. It's like the way he punctuates things is very peculiar. It's very melodic, very musical. He has a sense of precise cutting that makes the audience go, oh, every shot is important.
Yes.
In the heist of the armor truck, I love the way, I mean, you can, when you shoot action, I have shot action with 6 cameras. I've shot action with 13 cameras.
Yeah.
All shooting at the same time, by the way. And you have to be careful that the light works for all 13. You have to be completely certain that they're not going to see each other. We call it jokingly a Polish shooting squad. That, which is the way he shoots Kate Mantellini.
Yes.
Cameras barely out of range, one to the other, right? Facing each other.
Yeah.
2 cameras on each side, longer and shorter lens, blah, 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 you know?
Yeah.
So when you see the way, when the truck crashes against the armored car and then crashes against the cars in the parking lot, obviously you know that's not a real parking lot. That's probably not even it was a vacant lot. They made it into a car lot. All those cars were paid by production. This is probably one take.
Yep.
And you know that all the destruction is laid out, and then you see the camera that is waiting for the cars from behind, a lateral shot. He laid those cameras perfectly, and he knew what part he was using. I think is rhythmically very clear.
Yes.
That he knew he was going to go from here to here to here. And he doesn't overdo it. He has a very dry, he doesn't do the virtuoso shot.
No.
Oh, look at that. He doesn't want to distract you with that. And the parking cafeteria scene with Wingrove is strangely dry and almost ethereal, you know? You have a sense of a dreaminess to it. And then he ends up with that, a shot that is, even if you were in the editing event, you wouldn't go, that's a great shot. It's a shot.
Yeah.
It's rhythmically right. And then he goes to the beach, you know. You can teach most anything with one of his movies. You can teach editing. I always, when we talk about Hitchcock, I always say, well, everybody likes the shower scene in Psycho to teach editing. Me, I like to dissect the staircase scene at the end of Notorious.
Mm.
Cary Grant is carrying Ingrid Bergman, and Hitchcock knows mathematically that he has whatever, 30 steps, 40 steps, and he's going to keep track because it's an uninterrupted descent from the top to the bottom. And within that, he needs to accommodate a two-shot, a POV, a wide shot. So he knows. He has to know. It's mathematical filmmaking.
Yes.
And rhythmically, it's rhythmic filmmaking of a superior precision. He's not flamboyant.
No.
He's not showy. And the same is true of Michael Mann. You remember many, many shots of his movies, many.
Yes.
You remember, but the main thing you remember is a mood.
Yeah.
It's a state of mind. There's a complete Michael Mann-ness that comes with his films. That is the summation of somebody that is not only good with this or good with that, is good with everything.
Yes.
Everything is of a piece. If you have we were trying to explain tone the other day at a DGA Q&A, and I was saying is a absolute perfect fusion of the material, the acting, the visual, and the audio aspects of that includes cinematography, production design, wardrobe design. Nothing is not thought about and discussed.
Yes.
The suit of Tom Cruise in Collateral, it's one of the greatest pieces of construction.
Yes.
Is ever seen. I mean, it's as good as the Cary Grant suit in North by Northwest.
Is that,
you know, and is that multivalent, you know, it's this and is that and is this and is that. Everything. That scene is virtuoso. The scene in the drive-in. They scouted it. It's not like they saw the car and the car was bouncing on the uneven terrain and they went, oh wow, we screwed up. No, they scouted it, and Michael Mann as director, he didn't say, please even the terrain so the car can drive fast. No, he said, let's see the car bounce.
Yeah.
But that's the wisdom. See, directors make decisions, and decisions shape the material. If you are a lesser mind, you watch the car bumping and you go, by the day we come here, please have it all even so the car picks up speed, right?
Yeah.
But then you remove reality. And the decision to leave it in, that's a decision.
Yes.
That's a decision. And you watch that scene and as you say, there's always the eruption, the pause for reality.
Yes.
Right? For example, in the parking lot scene in the cafeteria, it's not that the police cruiser shows up. It's that the police cruiser makes a U-turn to chase somebody.
Somebody. Who knows?
A lesser director would have been perfectly happy with the cruiser just going by and turns the corner. or something, but he wants to show you a little bit of the zoology. This yeah. little predator goes and chases a rabbit, you know? But it was a wolf. It was a wolf. It's decision-making, never casual. Whether you are good or not, your decisions shape the material.
Yes.
And that's why anything, when they shake the detonator for a second before the-
yeah. One, two, three, and then it's-
And look at it rhythmically. It's musical construction.
Yeah.
That's when they go to the driver of the armored car and they do a very small, beautiful push in and dolly, you know, push on his face as the truck arrives. And they don't do a corresponding on the truck. They don't do another on the truck driver. It's just the truck becomes the character. That's a decision. Look, here's why I say this. When we did Pacific Rim, I said, I don't want people on the street.
Yeah.
I don't want people on the street because I don't want to think about them. I want everybody on a refuge or, you know, because all I want is the character, the robot and the kaiju. Those are the characters.
Yes.
The street is props.
Yes.
You know, when the robot comes dragging the boat, and uses it as a baseball bat. I don't want to be thinking of the sailors of the boat.
Yes.
I don't want to be thinking of people at their feet, because then rhythmically the scene becomes about three things.
Yes.
Like the attack on straw dogs is about three or four things happening simultaneously.
Yes.
You know, no, I want one thing. And there's a smart decision in going, I'm going to make that truck a character now. I'm not going to cut to the shifting of the gears or the point of view of the truck. No, that's a decision. It's as important what you leave in as what you omit. And that is easier said than done. It takes decades to come to the right decision on what to leave in and what to omit. This is hard to explain sometimes, but that's what makes his scenes so amazing. The omission or the inclusion of an everyday detail.
Well, I know that you are in the midst of editing your upcoming film, Nightmare Alley.
Editing and including, yeah.
Yeah, making these exact decisions. But I just wanted to say thank you so much for finally being part of the show, because, it's a dream for me to talk to you in any context, but to talk to you about Heat, knowing your love for Michael Mann, and talk to you on this show, which we just dedicated, you know, a couple of hundred episodes like this, dissecting every single moment of this incredible film and talking about Michael Mann. It's just a treat to talk to you. So Maestro, thank you so much for being a part of One Heat Minute.
I wish my life was more bohemian. We spend 100 episodes just talking about that, and then we would have Collateral to contend with, and then
we did a special series, the last 12 minutes of the Mohicans, just to talk about the ending, which Mr. Mann came on as well, which was a real treat. But now what's happening is the lure to talk about his incredible films in lots of different contexts just keeps scratching at the door. So, you know, it's something that might happen in the future. Right now we're on Zodiac. David Fincher's Zodiac Chronicle is what we're up to at the moment.
That's a miracle movie.
A miracle.
And I think that's a movie that is not only unassailable, but to me is unexplicable. again, if you gave me every resource in the world and you said, go to the Zodiac, I can. And I don't think anyone can but Fincher, by the way. No. Yeah. It's that blessed Olympus-sized marriage of material and director that happens once in a lifetime, twice in a lifetime, if you're really lucky. And after that, you're talking about God-level. this is truly, you know, try to decompose Zodiac into its parts. Try to, and then you will be flabbergasted as how is sustained purely by faith and courage in the filmmaking.
Yes.
It's astoundingly difficult to dissect that movie. Astoundingly difficult to dissect. Scenes, yesterday we went to see The Shining at the drive-in in L.A. Oh, and I always, I'm fascinated by many aspects of this movie, but the job interview.
One of the most underrated scenes in cinema history. It's so, it's the whole movie hinges, when you rewatch The Shining as many times as probably you and I have, the whole movie hinges on that job interview.
Yeah, and everything is there. And of course, people have pointed out the maze and Jack Nicholson.
This is tight.
Tie and all that, but everything is there. Everything is there. And that's the scene that, I tell you, most directors would say, let's make it briefer.
Yeah, let's move on.
It's too much. It's two guys talking in an office. Let's make it 2 minutes. And Kubrick says, I'll show you how you should do it. And he does it without, he doesn't do a camera that roams around or, anyway, goodbye, man. I gotta go.
Thank you.
We can have a coffee some other
day. See bye-bye. You. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Wow, Guillermo del Toro on One Heat Minute on Michael Mann. I hope that was as much fun for you guys as it was for me. Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe, rate, review our show. More Zodiac Chronicle coming at the end of the week. 3 big episodes this month to catch up, but I hope you thoroughly enjoyed that surprise as much as I did. My name is Blake Howard. This has been One Heat Minute.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.